What's the risk of COVID-19 infection among frontline healthcare workers?
Looking for a way to reopen schools during the COVID-19 pandemic.
And what's it going to take to reopen colleges during the same pandemic?
And COVID transmission and infection among overnight campers in Georgia.
That's what we're talking about this week on Double T Health Watch, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a Baltimore-based medical journalist.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, the one that's nearest and dearest to my heart is this risk of COVID-19 infection among frontline healthcare workers. This is in The Lancet Public Health. And this is a study taking a look at healthcare workers in both the UK and the US, utilizing a COVID symptom study smartphone app where they ask them about all of their symptoms and other demographic factors that are relative to the study. They had over 2 million community individuals and almost 100,000 frontline healthcare workers, and they recorded 5,500 plus incident reports of a positive COVID-19 test in this population at large. They found, disturbingly, that healthcare workers were unfortunately at least 3 times more likely to become infected with COVID-19 in comparison to the general population. They did say that those who reported adequate availability of personal protective equipment, that's about where they were. If you didn't report that you had adequate PPE, you were actually even at a greater risk. And if you were Black, Asian, or another ethnic minority, these people also seem to be disproportionately affected.
On the one hand, one might not be surprised that healthcare workers might be at an increased risk, especially those that have inadequate PPE. A couple things about this particular study. As you mentioned, it was a voluntary self-reporting on a mobile app. Whether these numbers, whether it's 1.5 times more likely or 2 or 3, I think it's very difficult just to tell from this study. It is surprising, though, that the minority individuals had a higher risk than the general population, although there's no explanation for that in the study. So it's an interesting use of an app, but I'm not sure that I put a lot of weight in the particular numbers.
Yeah, I still find it a little bit distressing, though, that the idea that even with adequate PPE, healthcare workers could still be at increased risk. And I would also second your ideas about the app. Certainly, now that we've had this paucity of contact tracing here in the U.S., lots of people are pointing to apps as one way to potentially augment actual physical or phone calls or whatever to try to do contact tracing. And I guess this says to me that, gosh, some people really are motivated to use apps.
They are, but Elizabeth, this doesn't tell you where the individuals actually got the infection. You assume it's in the healthcare setting, but it very well may not have been in the healthcare setting. And it may be just be that healthcare workers and healthcare professionals are more likely to be tuned in to symptoms, more likely to be tested, more likely to subscribe to the app as well. I think it's an interesting study, but again, it's not valid, in my opinion, in terms of putting an absolute number on that.
So you don't have big concerns about frontline healthcare workers and their potential for infection?
Do I think that the risk is increased potentially? Do I think that adequate PPE protects healthcare workers? There's no question about it. Do I think that they're more likely to subscribe to an app and report their symptoms in the general population? Absolutely, that as well.
We'll see. That's where I'm going to land on that one. Staying in The Lancet, in child and adolescent medicine, let's take a look at this idea that's getting so much attention right now in the U.S., the idea of, gosh, how are we going to, or are we going to, reopen schools?
There are two articles back to back. One actually reports the transmission of SARS-CoV-2 in the Australian educational setting. This is a prospective cohort study. And the other is a study that modeled the optimal strategy for reopening schools in the United Kingdom. So let's first turn our attention to the prospective cohort study. And what they did was they determined the laboratory confirmed pediatric and adult COVID-19 cases who attended a school, either primary, secondary, or even preschool, while they were considered infectious, and then they did contact tracing around those individuals. So 15 schools and 10 primary settings had a total of 27, either children or adults, who attended the schools while infectious. And those 27 individuals had 1,448 contacts that were monitored. Of these, about half of them had nucleic acid testing or antibody testing or both, and they only identified 18 secondary cases. That's an attack rate of 1.2%. Fairly minimal transmission in a pretty close setting. The next study looked at the optimal strategy for reopening schools. It had a number of different scenarios. If the school opened either entirely, if it opened kind of part-time, what testing was available, what percentage of testing, what they determined was essentially that they could prevent a second COVID wave infection, the first one having already occurred, as long as it was accompanied by large-scale population-wide testing of symptomatic individuals. And following that, effective tracing of the contacts and isolation of the diagnosed individuals. You say, well, how many people would have to be tested? Well, somewhere between 59 and 87% of symptomatic individuals. And again, that depends on how one opens school. And it presumes, by the way, that once the testing is done, that the contact tracing is initiated within 24 hours, and the individuals that are positive are quarantined for 14 days, and those that have symptoms, that at least 50% of them, even without testing, are quarantined. And if that's the case, it doesn't matter when the school opens or how it opens, they can prevent a second COVID-19 wave.
I think since the one in the colleges is similar, why don't we talk about that and then we can discuss a little bit some of these strategies. This other one about the colleges and what would it take is a modeling study. It's in JAMA Network Open. It just takes a look at what would we need to do in order to contain infection if we bring these college students back. They had a hypothetical cohort of 5,000 students. They only had in their cohort, in their modeling, 0.2% who actually were infected with the virus. They assumed an R-naught of 2.5 and daily screening with a 70% sensitivity test. When they use this model, they basically find out that what they need to do is screen every 2 days, even with something that's not the greatest test in the world. If they do that, they would be able to really kind of keep things under control. And they say that if they did that, the screening with a 70% sensitive test every 2, 1, or 7 days as a preferred strategy for R-naughts of 2.5, 3.5, or 1.5, right? So, okay, different scenarios. This could cost between $1,000 and $120 per student per semester to employ this strategy. And this is another thing that I think people are really checking out. How are we going to open schools? Is it prudent to open schools? And what are the consequences of not opening schools?
So regardless of whether it's a primary school, secondary school, preschool, or even college, the three things that all point to be able to do this safely is being able to test, to trace, and to isolate. And the question is, how much testing do you have available, whether you have adequate resources to trace, and then what finally has to isolate the individuals. Now, with regard to the college testing with 5,000 students, if you did it every other day, it would take 195,000 tests to be performed, even over a shortened semester. And the cost for that is upwards of, if it's $50 per test and you do it every other day, it's just about slightly under $10 million to do that. Now, that's not very practical in the college setting. However, if one did all the things that one was supposed to do, and that is to prevent infected individuals from coming on campus, to try to keep them on campus, to make sure they're socially distanced and they isolate and they wear a mask and wash their hands, then testing wouldn't have to be done every other day. In the setting of the primary schools that I mentioned, testing wasn't done on every individual every other day. It was performed on symptomatic individuals. But there was adequate tracing and adequate isolation to make sure that once it's identified, that that cohort of students or faculty is isolated and to prevent the spread. So again, those three things are necessary regardless of what the school setting is.
And I would just remind our listeners that last week an Israeli school that did open already and then made the unfortunate decision to allow their students to take their masks off because it was ferociously hot, I gather, had a really big outbreak and subsequently ended up having to close. So I guess my take home from all of this is I get all of the precautions and I'm still concerned about the level of infection that's possible.
And certainly the level of infection that's possible is related to what the underlying prevalence is. And again, these physical distancing. And that leads right into the next study. That is the study of overnight camping in Georgia that was reported really just a little over a month ago. This is in June 2020. And this was, again, an overnight camp in which there were 120 staff members, 138 trainees, and over 346 campers. Soon after the camp began, within 3 or 4 days, one of the staff members left camp after they developed chills the previous evening. That staff member was tested and found to be positive, so they began sending campers home the next day. In fact, they closed the camp 3 days later. But what happened in that intervening period was 44% of the individuals at that camp actually ended up being COVID infected. Now, what did the camp do? Did the camp ask campers to wear masks? Absolutely not. Now, they asked the staffers and trainees to do it, but they didn't ask the campers to do it. And the vast majority of people at the camp were, in fact, campers. Now, they looked at it with regard to how many people were in each of the cabins, whether it was a small number of individuals, 1 to 3, a medium number, 7 to 13, or a large number, 16 to 26. And interestingly enough, in the smaller inhabited camp cabins, the infection rate was about 40%, but that's still pretty high. In the larger cabins, it was as high as 56%. And the infection rate did tend to go down with age, and that is individuals 20 to 29, those were primarily the staffers. The infection rate was only 29%, whereas around 40 to 50% in the campers. But again, I'm not terribly surprised because many of the staffers were wearing masks, whereas the campers were not.
Let's just mention this is in Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. So lots and lots of, again, evidence that the distancing, the masking, the hygiene efforts are really, really important in order to reduce transmission and gathering bunches of people where there, it says in here, vigorous daily singing and cheering where they're spreading all kinds of stuff out there. And of course, we're learning that aerosols and respiratory droplets are important is probably not a great idea.
Yeah, but again, there will be situations where we do have larger gatherings. Again, schools are those gatherings where we can minimize the face-to-face exposure. When we can physically distance and wear a mask and wash our hands and do the things, then we can reduce the risk and minimal, as was demonstrated in Australia, as was demonstrated in the modeling study, and as demonstrated in the modeling study looking at college as well.
On that note, that is a look at this week's medical headline from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.